Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Welcome to part two of a four-part program featuring the internationally renowned designer and potter, Michael Dillon. In part one, we learned that Michael was born in Manangatang, Victoria, where he spent his formative years before the family moved to Bendigo when he was around 11 years of age. This was certainly a period and time where Michael would begin to give form to his creative abilities. Michael shares stories of his tertiary education experiences and how he went from a mediocre student to a top student, and he shares in wonderful detail how he obtained an amazing professional industry placement as part of his course with the highly prestigious Wedgwood Company in the UK. However, while taking us onto his experiences in England, Michael also talks about his stay in Singapore, where his limited understanding of cultural differences are suddenly rapidly and wonderfully expanded. There are so many stories, including how fate helped him miss being hurt in a hand grenade attack on the Australian High Commission during the internal political upheavals in and around Singapore in the mid-1960s. However, he does get to the UK, and it is here that his story in so many ways really begins. We start off with Michael talking about how an anticipated experience as a student at Scotch College changed into an experience at the local technical college. So as a boy, you learn you can't go to Scotch, you've got to go to the technical school. Did you just take that or did you feel you were missing out?
I just proceeded ahead because I had no measure of the Scotch College part and I didn't have much of a measure of the other one either. But I knew that from a psychological point of view, I had to sort of preserve myself.
Mm-hmm.
So given that we had already been guided properly by our parents, then I followed what they said. And that was my benchmark or measuring stick as to how it would be. It was, of course, in the technical school, much more orientated towards practical things. But art was one of my areas. So by 16, I applied to go into what was then called the Bendigo School of Mines.
Yes.
And I went there.
Right.
And then it changed to a whole series of changes. It's now part of La Trobe University. And I started out, my first year I was mediocre. Second year, I got better. Third year, I got extremely better. And by the fourth year, I'd risen up to the top.
Good for you.
And I'd entered some competitions, which I had won against other people mm-hmm. in the state. And I decided, because I was on a scholarship for the last 2 years at the School of Mines, and because that course was 4 years.
Right.
So by 20, I'd finished the 4 years, and then we had to do 2 years of professional practice. And it had to be done properly. You couldn't fib it or do. It had to be real.
Did you do that as a placement somewhere, or was that all in the school?
You had to get a professional practice job yourself.
So where did you end up?
I wrote to two places. I wrote to Noritake in Kyoto in Japan.
Right.
And I wrote to Wedgwoods.
In England.
In England. So I wrote in both cases, to the design director. I didn't know the name of the directors, respectively.
Yeah.
I had a reply. That was in early January of 65. So I finished my 4 years, and I was now making application for the professional practice.
Yes.
A couple of weeks, 3 weeks after that, I got a reply back from Noritake, a very nice letter. I knew that I had little chance of getting a job because I didn't read or speak Japanese.
Yes.
And Japan then was very insular.
Yes.
They were employing their own, and that was it. So I was pleased to get a reply, and it was a typical sort of reply that you get out of Asia, as I learned to understand much later on.
Yeah.
The other letter went to the design director of Wedgwoods in Barlaston, which is 7 miles short of Stoke-on-Trent in Staffordshire, 154 miles up from London. The design director, whose name was Victor Skellen, he wrote back. But I had proceeded to make application for my passport without having a reply from Wedgwoods, one only from Kyoto, from Noritake. And I had made friends with a number of Chinese students during my course here in Australia, either out of Hong Kong. When I met them, I was 16. Some of them were 25 years of age. They'd had their education blocked because of Mao Zedong coming into China, taking over in 49. Mm-hmm. These people came from wealthy families and they had to leave quickly and went to Hong Kong. So they became friends. Others who were southern Chinese, but who were always born in Hong Kong, I made friends with them. Then there were others from Ipoh in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, Johor Bahru in the bottom part of Malaysia, and Singapore, two of whom became part of our family. They were older than me, 7 or 8 years older. Both of them were pretty well off. One boy, his father was a director of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank at the time.
Oh, very well off, yes.
And he had plenty of money, and they knew he had plenty of money, and they used to go and borrow from him. Of course, they wanted to gamble. And the other one was a chap called Alan Way, who became part of our family. His birthday, ironically, was the same day as my mother. So he used to come to the house, whether I brought him to the house or not. And he liked gambling. My father used to have a punt, and they were good friends. It was lovely.
So you were saying you applied for your passport?
Yes, I applied for it, and then I went through all the processes. I came to the British Consul's office here in Melbourne to get a work permit. I couldn't get one because I wasn't high enough up, and like if I'd been a nuclear physicist or something. I said, okay. So I knew that when I went into England, if I didn't have a letter from Wedgwoods, I was going to be in trouble.
Mm.
So my initial concept was to spend 10 days in Singapore and then from there go on to London.
And just hope for the best.
And hope for the best. So I had arranged with my parents that every night after I got to Singapore, I would ring up because they were worried. I mean, I was only 20 and a quarter.
Mm.
And so that was fine to ring up. It was no trouble. And then after the second day that I called, on the second day, my mother said, oh, there's a letter here from Wedgwoods. And I said, well, she hadn't opened it. I said, open it and what have you. And she said, oh, they've offered you a position. And I said, excellent. I said, take what you've opened, put it into a fresh, bigger envelope, and send it to me.
Yes.
Of course, postal then was quick. It was...
Yeah, it's funny about that.
Singapore was...
Faster.
No, it was really fast.
That's right.
So I was going to be there for another 8 days.
Right.
I could have extended if I'd wanted. And I thought, well, that's going to be adequate. So I left to go to Singapore on the 9th of March, 1965. Whilst I was there, I went to the races. One night I went to a birthday party. I went to the Metal Box Company. That was a British company.
In Singapore?
Yes, because my friend's Alan Way, his father was quite highly regarded in Singapore, and he was head of the Singapore Chin Woo Association. The Chin Woo in English means athletic.
Oh, okay.
They had lion dancers. And when they opened a new part of this metal box factory, the lion dancers were brought for because it's auspicious and whatsoever.
Yeah.
So everybody, we went there. They're all dressed up, what have you. And I felt a bit out of it but because it was all, everything was new. But it was also very helpful because it reminded me that I had to start to think for myself way beyond what I'd done. And so we went to the metal box, we went to the birthday party, we went to a funeral, and we went to a Chinese theatre. This Chinese theatre was out of communist China. at that time, highly unusual.
Mm.
Very unusual. It was a small one, but it was fantastic. Plates on sticks and all this. It was great. I'd never seen the like of it before. And I remember saying to Alan, how can we go to... I said, I don't know which one came first. I think the funeral came first. It was out in the street. I said, how can we go to these... I said, this seems to me rude to me. And now we're going to go to somebody's birthday party. And he said, that's how it is here.
You're beginning to learn about cultural differences, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes.
And I like that, because if I go back briefly to Menangatang, the first foreign person I met was when I was 7 years of age. And that chap was a Colombo Pan student. He was 30 years of age plus. He'd been brought up to Menangatang to meet my father, and he was doing a study of agriculture in Victoria. And I remember standing in the middle of the street in front of my father's business, the stock business, and his shop in the front. And I and this Indonesian man talked for about 30 minutes, having a chit-chat, and that was the first foreign person that I met. So I was never, even when I went to college and even before I went to England, when I was in Bendigo, I never used to think, I mean, then to bring some of those students home, people said to me, why are you having those people here?
I know, I said,
you're out of order. I said, what do you mean, those people?
Yes.
I said, they've got 5,000 or 6,000 years of history. I mean, get a grip on reality.
Mm-hmm.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices, featuring the life and times of older Australians. I'm Rob Grooves, and I'm talking with Michael Dillon. And Michael is recollecting stories from the period of his life when, at the age of 20, he left for the UK via Singapore.
So it sounds like you were really enjoying your stay in Singapore.
I did. I was thinking about staying there.
I wondered about that, yes.
And I thought, I'm going to go down to the High Commission in Napier Road in Singapore. And Singapore then was just lovely. It was nothing like it is now. It's just the antithesis of it. And I had an appointment on a Wednesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then something came up and I rang them and said, look, something has come up for the Wednesday at 3 and I have to be whatever that is. Can we make the 3 o'clock Wednesday, 3 o'clock Thursday?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, fine. I'm lucky that I changed my time and the date in particular, because at 3 o'clock on the Wednesday, hand grenades among a range of other goodies were thrown into the Australian High Commission, because at that time, Sukarno, who was head of Indonesia, Bung Sukarno, he was causing a lot of trouble because he wanted to take back all of Malaya, Singapore, and all of Borneo, which meant Sarawak and Sabah, because he said it belonged to them.
Mm.
And at that time, it's hardly ever been reported here, there were Australian commandos in Singapore and in little islands around Indonesia and all the rest of it. But it was not a mention of it was made then. It was all hush-hush because they weren't supposed to be there. And, of course, it has a diplomatic... reaction.
Oh, yes, yes.
If it becomes known. So I was lucky because three people were killed, others were injured, cars upended out the front and all the rest of it. And the Aussie embassy then, like was say, it wasn't as big as the American, but it was pretty big. The British was same as the US, but it was a prominent place. And when you went around in the car during that time, because it had been labelled in Indonesian language confrontation against the British and anybody else who were supporting the Malays and the Chinese.
Mm.
So that scared the hell out of me.
So it was time to get out?
No, I didn't think it like
you
that.
You didn't think
no,
it like
I didn't.
That?
I'm not frightened like that. I've always tried to rationalise things.
But wasn't Wedgwood still calling you?
I had the letter then.
Yes, you had the letter, but weren't you torn between staying and still getting to Wedgwood?
Yes. I had two chances to stay in Singapore. That was one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was later on. And if I'd done that, it would have been a very different thing altogether. But I could mention that later on, perhaps. No, I finally settled that I would go at least and try, because I got a shock that they accepted me.
Mm.
Because it wasn't just, well, you can have a job and you can work in different parts of the factory. That's what I'd asked for, so that I could build up a technical knowledge. It wasn't that. It was that plus employing me. They already had one boy. His name was David Puxley. He was a year older than me, and he came from Oxford. He'd been there 6 months already. He came in September of 1964. I started in the last week of working at Wedgwood's, in the last week of March of 1965. The whole concept was, as far as the design director was concerned, was that he, Puxley, and I would be given carte blanche authority. We were answerable to two people, the CEO of the company and the design director, and to nobody else. Wedgwood's at that time employed about 2,400 people. It was a huge factory stuck in the middle of 7,000 plus acres of land. It looked like something out of Disneyland. There were dairy cattle grazing about. There were tennis courts, soccer ground, hall for socials and this and that, little bridges over little streams and rivers. They had their own railway station, and everybody grovelled accordingly. Grovelling was the one thing that struck me at the beginning, and it was appalling.
Yes.
And I got caught.
Oh.
I got caught one day.
In what way?
In that they, in the beginning, they mocked me in terms of the way that I spoke. And, of course, those, Puxley came from Oxford. When he spoke, his was class. Beautiful.
Yes.
And he used to think before he spoke, which I observed. The others who were there were all from Staffordshire. Their accent was different.
Oh, yes.
And there were slightly different ones.
In between, yes.
Like 10 miles could make a big difference.
Yes, yes. Regional.
So they would mock me and whatever. And the CEO of the company, Sir Arthur Bryan, who was the first non-Wedgwood family member ever to run a company,
mm-hmm.
he would come in. The guy that was about 60 years of age, he was in charge of packaging up special items and whatever, and his section was next to mine and Puxley's, where we worked in the design studios, and he would come and say, oh, he's on his way. He's on his way around, which I said, who is? And they said, they said, Sir Arthur Bryan. And I thought, well, God, you're just about one step away from wetting yourself. What's the problem? But they were frightened. And this guy was only 45, right? He was younger than the aforementioned 60-year-old. Mm. So he used to come in and say, oh, hello, Eric, how are you? And that. But he wasn't like that himself. That wasn't his real voice.
Oh.
Because he'd been promoted. He was a local lad, and he'd gone up the... Yes. He was smart.
Obviously.
He ran the operation in the United States for 2 years before he was brought back and...
In charge.
In 4 years, he'd taken 2,500 people up to over 9,000 employees, and he bought up a whole heap of other ceramic companies in Stoke-on-Trent, an unbelievable amount. Now it's just gone.
I was in Stoke-on-Trent only about 3 or 4 years ago, and I was quite dismayed because I went there expecting to see all these great pottery places.
They used to be.
Yes, and it was empty. Well, not empty.
Where I used to go shopping in the old days, they had bottle kilns. Not when I was there, but they still had them standing up.
Yes.
And in Hanley, which is one of the five towns, they had these bottle kilns, and guess what was next door? A Woolworths supermarket.
Oh,
no.
Oh.
Listen to older voices, the magic of memories.
So Arthur would come in and say, oh, hello, Eric, how are you? And so I was mocking Puxley. Half the area where we worked were Nissan huts. They'd used them during the war.
Yes.
And the modellers were on one side in their offices, and then there was a passage here, and then it came into the area where Puxley and I were. I was on the potter's wheel, and I looked up and I saw Sir Arthur Bryan come in, and the design director. By then, Scallon had passed away from cancer, unfortunately, the poor bugger. And Peter Wall was his replacement. It was just a disaster. His face was the colour of that. And he was behind the CEO. And I thought, well, either I join Grovelling Unlimited as a fully paid-up member today, or I hold my line. And I thought, I'm not going to join Grovelling Unlimited. There's already an overflow of members. There's got plenty. They don't need another one.
So you held the line.
And I didn't look away from him.
And what happened?
He walked up to me and he said, good morning, Michael. I said, good morning, Mr. Bryan. How are you? Fine. How are you? Good. A week later, I got a phone call from his private secretary to present myself at 10 o'clock the following Saturday morning at the tennis courts.
Oh, that's not what I thought you were going to say.
No, I know you're not.
No, I thought it was going to be...
So,
no.
So I started playing tennis here when I was 14. By the time I was 15, I could beat all of them men in the club, and I played in our team, in a competition. I played until I was 18, and then I couldn't play anymore because of my studies. I had four nights at school and 5 days, and was round the clock anyhow because I did work at home, because I found a lot of my work was being copied. I wanted to do 2 degrees, and they wouldn't let me. Stuart Devlin was one of the people who wouldn't. Stuart Devlin was about 8 years older than me. He was really young. He's a bright bastard. And he was an art inspector. And I said, look, I want to do a ceramics degree and the painting degree. I've got the work for it. And they wouldn't do it. He did.
And then today it's done all the time now.
Well, he went to the Royal College and did 2 there. Anyhow, I rang him up when I was in London and spoke to him. He got a surprise. By then I was at Wedgwood's. But he did the decimal coinage.
Oh, right, yes. The designing.
So fronted up at the tennis courts with my Schlesinger racket. How many people were there? There were 3 others. So Sir Arthur Bryan, the CEO, the head of Wedgwood's America, who was visiting for business reasons, and the works manager, Mr. Richardson.
So you're in high company.
He was the oldest one.
Right.
And I got on well with Richardson. Richardson was would have got on with anybody. He was a decent sort of man, and he liked me. And so he and I played, it was doubles, he and I played for our team. So we played, and I played to win. I knew I couldn't play, otherwise we're going to get back into Grovelling Unlimited again.
Yes.
So I played as hard as I could. And then we finished our match. And then Bryan said, we're going back to my place because we're going to have drinks and some food and what have you. So I went with Richardson, and Bryan took the American guy, who was also unbelievably young. And then we started to go towards where Richardson lived. He lived on the estate, so did I. There were houses there for the for the seniors people. I said, where are you going? I said, we're supposed to go and have drinks. And he said, oh, I've got to go to the toilet. I said, well, let's go to the toilet over there. No, you can't do that. I said, what do you mean you can't do it? So we went there. I went there as well. I mean, I'm not going to...
Well, you can't do much.
So I played 2 or 3 times. I think 3 times I played tennis like that.
So you're obviously held in quite high esteem.
Well, I think so.
I'm not trying, you know, I'm not trying to make you...
Well, I only had that answered when I found out about the show in Washington.
So hang on, okay, what's the show in Washington?
That was the 250th anniversary of Wedgwood's.
And were you still working for Wedgwood?
No, this is 2009.
Okay, well then let's come to that when we get a little bit further on.
Okay.
Next week, in part three of his story, we share more intriguing stories about his Wedgwood experiences and his experiences in several Scandinavian countries before Michael takes us on to his time in the USA. That's next week, part three of The Life and Times of Michael Dillon on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.